Ha! Not football, just... Welcome to the Survivor Turning Back Time podcast, the only Survivor podcast that traps the devil somewhere in Long Island.
It's got to be there somewhere, right?
I'm your host, Jared Sheldon, my co-host, Stephen Labine. Stephen, how are you doing today?
The devil is out and is Egyptian, I guess. Well, and also a very attractive lady.
There's devils of many cultures. Oh, you like them crazy, huh?
Hey, devil went down to Georgia.
Devil went down to Jersey in this case.
Looking for a soul to steal.
Yes, so
she was in a bind. She was way behind. She was willing to make a deal.
She was in a bind in a room.
Yeah.
Specifically.
Yeah.
We watched The Infernal Room, made, starred in, directed by, et cetera, friend of the show, Billy Garcia.
All of the things by Billy Garcia.
Now, here's the thing, guys. Last season, I said I couldn't find any of Billy's movies. That's because they aren't online anymore. So Billy did us a solid and sent us a link to it. He re-uploaded it. I asked him if we could provide that link. I'm waiting to hear back. So we'll see. I don't know if he wants that out in the world. It is a project from 15 years ago.
And I wonder about...
legality and all that.
Yeah, if you need people's permissions for that too. So I wouldn't be surprised if he's like, no... And yeah. I'd be like, yeah, that makes sense.
Yep. So this might be one of those that we talk about that you have no way to see. And, you know, in retrospect, maybe we should stop doing that, Steven.
You don't say. Oh, my God.
But this felt too good to have a contestant that had been on the show and had made some movies. And so why not?
This is a connection that we had to take up. Yeah.
Yeah, it was fun. So, as I mentioned, this one's called The Infernal Room. It was produced by Tribal Council Entertainment.
That's nice. Way to go, Billy, on that one.
Way
I
to
like
go,
that.
Billy. Yeah, you can still find the website if you go on the Wayback Machine, because that's
oh, really?
How I tried to find the movie the first time.
Sure.
Listen, if it's there, I will find it. It wasn't there.
It wasn't there.
So, Stephen, before we get into it, overall impressions of the movie, but first for our audience, I guess I'll say, this will be much more along the Seeking Mr. X scale of like the way that we talk about things, because this is clearly like amateur. Billy did not have millions of dollars put behind this. This isn't Honorable Men. This isn't Gone, where it's like, oh, a professional film team from Hollywood or the Philippines or whatever, like, had the backing of a studio. Like, this is a
really putting Gone as a professional film.
I mean,
it is.
Yeah, that Timothy Shea has money.
Timothy
I think that was his name.
Chalamet.
I that might not have been his name. I don't remember. I'm going off of memory, which is, for me, very fallible. So we're not going to be, like, don't expect us to Gone this.
No. We're gonna poke little holes in there, but this isn't, like, me going to town dunking on a studio that had a lot of money and time and resources. This is one... maybe a few people putting their time and effort into this, and this was a passion project.
It's the difference between going to a restaurant and the food tasting bad and your friend making you a meal and having some fun with them about it, basically, because this is not professional. It wasn't released with any type of budget. It might have gone to festivals, but I don't even remember that. So it'll be a different vibe. But Steven, what are your overall impressions?
Do you want to do impressions first, or do you want, like, a breakdown of what this movie is?
Oh, sure. Okay, we can do the breakdown first,
I feel like
I
that
guess.
Makes sense, right? Because we're talking about something that nobody has seen.
This is why you're typically the host.
That's what I do.
And I'm the co-host. All right. So, we open the movie with a really long list of credits, and it is always a red flag in a professional thing you're seeing, a la The Room or Birdemic or something like that, when the same person is the writer, the director, the producer, and all of that, and you go, ugh. Now, the difference is Billy's not independently wealthy like Tommy Wiseau, so it's a very different vibe. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Disaster Artist, great film. There's a lot of exposition in this opening scene. So our opening scene is Billy and his friend, I don't remember her name, talking in front of a door, which is like the front door of a house, which is not the infernal room, but the infernal room does lie inside of this house. And we keep cutting back and forth between them talking and then having like wide shots of both of them talking. And we paused it when that scene was done. And it was 13 minutes in.
It was a long time sitting in front of that one door.
That is about 15% of the movie. It's an hour and 15 minutes
by
long.
The minute for that door. Like, hey, can we use your door stem?
Maybe, or more likely, as somebody who's done amateur films, that might have just been someone in the cast's door, or maybe a random door of someone that they knocked and they weren't home and they went, cool, let's bang this out real quick.
You make the most out of your resources when you got them.
Guerrilla filmmaking is actually kind of fun sometimes, I'm not going to lie.
Jared, there was not even one gorilla in this movie.
How spoilers. So a lot of exposition around Billy and not real Billy. I'm going to keep saying Billy. His name in the movie is also Billy. So from here on out, we're talking about Billy, the character in the movie, to be clear.
Honestly, easiest way for you to learn your character names, if they're just your names.
It's true. So apparently it's the storm of the century in Jersey or Long Island or wherever we're at in the greater New York area for this film, because everyone has a Jersey or Long Island accent.
The dialects are in there. You can't get rid of them.
Yeah. Although not the people who didn't have them, I think, because like Billy didn't put on a Long Island accent or anything like that. He just talked like Billy.
No, but Billy's kind of traveled all over the place. He's a man of the people. He has ditched whatever dialect he's got.
True, yeah. Well, he didn't put one on for this. It wasn't like they had a dialect coach that's like, oh, all right, and this is how you talk Jersey.
No, I think we just took people from the New York, New Jersey area, and we're like, all right.
You want to make a film?
Yeah, let's make a film. Let's do it. As very referenced by the one guy who had a bar t-shirt that we could read.
We'll get there. Yeah, that was pretty cool. So they're supposed to be going to this party. They're all grad students, I guess. They're supposed to be going to this party that's down the block or like next door.
Except for the one sophomore who's very explicit about
Well,
that.
Yes, that's true. And everyone in this movie treats rain like it is acid. Where they like don't, they're like, no, we can't go to the party. It's raining too hard. And it's mentioned multiple times. It's like next door. But this is all ploy for Billy to propose to his girlfriend.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So they show up and it's like him, his friend that he's been talking to, like, I think her boyfriend is coming, and then Billy's girlfriend, their other friend that's kind of a dweeb, and they keep calling her a bimbo named Claire that's like his date for the night. It's like, oh, it's not a long-term thing. It's just to get him out of his shell. Okay. We needed the person that could die, and none of us would feel bad about it.
Sure.
And at one point in this 13-minute shot, her friend goes inside the house, which, mind you, this is just some random house. This is just a professor's house that is at the party. So they're like, don't worry, we know he's not home. We'll just go into this house.
Oh, I completely missed that part.
Yeah. Oh, this isn't like a rental or like a friend of theirs.
I thought it was just a random house that they like go in to get out of the rain.
I think not. I think the party is cover for them to use this place for Billy to propose to his girlfriend, which doesn't make sense, but we'll move right past that.
Sure.
Yeah, so at one point, the friend goes inside, and then the other girl, I think it might have been Claire, or the girlfriend, steps into the exact same place the first girl was talking to Billy, so that they didn't have to move cameras.
It's pretty funny.
Which, you gotta save time on a thing like this.
You know what? Go for it.
I will say, this seems like the kind of thing that was a blast to make. Like, some of my, like, student films or, like, indie films I've done that were much, much shorter than this. I do think an hour 15 is really ambitious and is a lesson to those of you that want to get into whatever art form it may be. Start small. An hour 15 is a really, really long movie where, like, it felt like they were maybe thin on resources and time with some of the scenes.
Yeah, it felt like this was, like, a 24-hour film project where you're on a few locations. You have to get everything filmed in like 24, 48 hours, and then whatever post-production takes as long as post-production takes.
Sure, yeah. Well, they have a lot of special effects.
They have a lot of special effects, which is fun. I give them credit for that.
There's this weird part where Billy's having a conversation on the phone in front of this door, but it's like Schrodinger. Everyone on the phone in this movie is Schrodinger's phone call. You can't tell if the other person's actually responding, if a conversation is happening, or if it's just being interpreted. And I also think, reading between the lines of somebody that's done some film, I think there were very many scenes in this that were not scripted.
Sure.
They were given bullet points and told to make it their own. And that is an exact thing you hear in the industry. Just make it your own. That means we didn't write anything here. Go ahead and
go do something.
Really common in commercials, as you're now aware, Steven.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Still getting that Chevy money. It keeps coming in.
Hell yeah. Yeah, so they just, like, squat in this house. There's a character, the one who threw the party, whose name is Mischievous M. Now, I want you all to take a second and picture what you think Mischievous M looks like in your head. Okay, so you're wrong. Mischievous M is not a rapper, a white rapper, like, from the Beastie Boys or something. It's just, like, a 27-year-old blonde woman. It's hilarious. I don't know. It subverted my expectations, and it was hilarious.
There's a lot of subverting expectations here.
That is true. And yeah, this whole, like, towards the end of this 13-minute scene in the house, I know that it's a horror movie, and sometimes you're fine with those people being bad people. Man, do we talk real bad about women for a long time.
It was a different time, Jared.
There's a lot of bimbo talk. Yeah. There's a lot of, oh, you're just using it for sex, but then it's like, ah, you're actually a real softie. Anyway. Then we get into our party, which is, they sped up the dance footage to make it look like everyone was dancing faster than they were. And there's always a thing that happens in any media that doesn't have a quadrillion dollars to actually, like, basically throw a club party, which is a character say, this is the best party ever. And you're like, that is seven people dancing.
Yeah.
Seven people.
Can I take a moment? Because we introduce a character here. Professor Longfellow.
Yep, that's my next note.
I thought that this was taking a curve into, like, oh, this is a porno suddenly.
And the music underneath it too is very, like,
it's very synth heavy.
Synth heavy. And it does feel like we're transitioning into a porno because the music's loud in the dialogue. And now we've met Professor Longfellow, who's also a creep. There's a whole bit about, like,
there's a lot of creeps in this movie.
Oh, don't worry. We'll make sure that no one has their camera phone here. And he's like, oh, this is a grad school party. You're all adults. And it's like, oh, so you did that at an undergrad party? Ugh, 10 years a hell of a thing.
Have you ever met, like, a creepy professor like that?
Yes. I had a high school teacher that has never been accused of anything, but always gave me a little bit of bad vibes. Mm. He was also a youth group pastor. Whoa. It wasn't like an official, he didn't go to school to be a pastor, so I guess, like, help or, like,
sure, whatever. He's participating with the youth group.
Was in the leadership of the youth group. Yeah, yeah. And he was always just a little too handsy with the high school girls. That made me a little uncomfortable, but nobody ever said, there's no allegations, there's nothing. And he's still doing all of that, and seems to be fine.
It's really unfortunate the amount of people who I know who are problematic and also in youth group positions.
The
number is not zero.
No, the Venn diagram's almost a circle.
I won't say that because I know some really cool people who are also youth group leaders.
It's too close to a circle.
It's closer than it should be.
It looks more like the MasterCard symbol than it should.
There should be two parallel lines, and there are not.
There's an ad in the back of this that looks like a handwritten, like, Sharpie thing for something called Affordable Caterers that has an email address. And I can't tell if that was their way of getting, like, craft services, and then they put that in there, if it's for the party, because I've never been to a party where they're advertising the catering. I've never been to a college party that was catered at all. It's a choice.
Some fancier parties definitely have, like, this was catered by this catering company. And usually it's, like, a table card or something put in a little plastic sleeve that you can be like, oh, yeah, if I want to get this later, go to this.
That's fair. Okay.
But those are fancier parties, not at any college party I've seen.
And then we come back from the college party. We are in... So this scene, this, like, there's only a few locations they shot in. Again,
we jump back and forth between the place that houses the Inferno Room and this party hall.
Yeah, and the party is unclear where it's supposed to be. I would think house party when I think party like this, but it looks like it's some type of, like, community center, but then they put up, like, felt so that you can't see stuff on the wall. Again, that's the thing of having no budget.
That's probably more for the movie.
Yes.
For them to be like, let's not dox all of these local community events.
It probably was like a local community college or something.
Yeah.
So, where is the Infernal Room, Steven, in time and space?
Well, when I started this, I thought it was this, like, liminal not actually part of reality space. Mm-hmm. And then the further we went into this, I went, oh no, this is literally just a room that she's locked in.
So,
and it could be anywhere.
It could be anywhere as the infernal room if you believe hard enough is what we end up finding out. But first, this location that we're shooting in that is outside of the infernal room, it looks like it's like a motel balcony almost, because the door that is the infernal room door has a key card reader. Oh, this is also on a school. I bet this is like the door to a classroom or something.
Could be.
Yeah. Anyway, there's that, and there's some chairs around. We have like awkward group conversations that kind of like are over top of each other. It's the audio mixing very hard. Audio is the hardest part of making a film.
Audio is hard, period, as referenced by the Survivor Turning Back Time podcast.
Even harder when you aren't sitting stationary in front of a microphone with no video.
Correct.
And also the year is like 2010 or whenever they filmed this. So outside of that is a few Anubis statues or different Egyptian god statues.
Outside is generous. It's kind of just in like a wing of this other room.
Sorry, outside of the infernal room door. Like literally, sure. Like right outside this door is like this end table with this.
Uh-huh. Which brings up my next point.
Uh-huh.
Why are these just sitting out if they give you a direct link to the devil?
No, shut up though.
Okay.
We'll get there in a second, but shut up though. And then we go back to the party for some reason, and we're grinding on people, and that's fine.
That's
it's 2010. That's a party. Yeah, I just wrote down, does everyone here melt in the rain? Because once again, they're like the bimbo, quote-unquote, girl, Claire, is like, come get me. These guys suck. Literally right behind where they're sitting also, by the way. And they don't seem to hear her.
Yeah. I'm not exaggerating when I'm like, it's 3 feet away from these people having a conversation. And she's just like, fuck these guys.
They suck. Which she did say that to their faces as well, I suppose.
Oh, that works.
And she's on the phone with somebody at the party. She won't walk there because it's raining, even though it seems to be less than a block away or whatever. And then we get a shot of somebody's t-shirt that we looked up, and it was the Bushwick Country Club, which is a bar and mini golf place.
Yeah, it looks cool. In Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn, in Bushwick. It's still open. It looked kind of cool.
Hell yeah.
I'm not going to lie. And then we touch our statue.
Oh, Jared.
Oh, my. This does get close to a porno a couple of times, let's be real. She touches the statue and she sees a vision. This is the bimbo Claire. Sees a vision of a girl in leather with fire behind her. And she's just staring directly into the camera. And it's flashing back and forth between the two things. And then she starts having a seizure.
Okay, sorry. I do have to pull aside. And again, I love you, Billy. The grabbing of the statue and the take directly to camera made me laugh multiple times.
Yes. Well,
it happens more than once.
It's very camp.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I almost wanted this to go more into camp, where I was like, I want everyone to be hamming it up actually like more than they are.
Right. If you're going hard, go all the way.
That's how you combat like being newer at something like this, especially for horror, and not having the budget and not having the equipment, is like just make it ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Like go to 11. All the music in this is really good.
It's so good.
Some of it is a little persistent. Like it's almost like a video game where you're stuck in a level sometimes where it loops a little bit.
But I almost guarantee that all this music was made by Billy and Billy's band. And like it was good.
Yeah, I enjoyed it quite a bit, especially the opening song. I forgot to mention that earlier.
You're right. Probably needed a little more variety, but from what I heard, I was never like, all right, this is getting tired. It's just like, oh yeah, I've heard this before.
Yeah. So one of the guys that is in this group of friends sees that Claire is having a seizure and is like, whoa, she touched that and now she's having a seizure. She shouldn't touch things that don't belong to her. And I just wanted to go, my guy. And he does this for several minutes. What? Why do you? I mean, yeah, that is what's happening. But why is that?
How would you know that?
Why do you think her touching things that don't belong to her equals seizure? Because you seem to be blaming her for touching things that don't belong to her.
Maybe they have a history. Maybe there's a past in there where they're like, she keeps touching things. She keeps having the seizures. Just stop touching things.
I keep telling her, if you touch things that don't belong to you, it'll give you seizures.
She went to the aquarium. She touched a jellyfish. She had a seizure. I can't stop her.
She put her hand through the glass. And they all know that this happened to her after touching the statue. I just wouldn't touch the statue. I just wouldn't, just in case. But now we see Billy's girlfriend do it. And then Billy does it.
Yep.
So by the third time we've realized, okay, let's not touch the statue. And as Steven pointed out earlier, it seems to give you some type of direct link to
the devil.
To the Egyptian god Set. That is the devil for this movie's purposes.
Yeah, devil equivalent.
Yes. Every
religion has a devil.
Well, fun fact, I did look up a little bit about Set while we were, when we were done watching the movie. Set is not necessarily an evil god.
Hmm.
Once monotheistic religions took precedence, he became one. He is the god of chaos, but was seen much more as like an equal to Ra. And they were like in some stories, brothers, some stories, cousins. They fought to be like the king of Egypt, but sure.
This is more of a Hades equivalent.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, like someone who is like I am lord of the underworld. I have no malice toward these people. It's just my job.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so now one person's still having a seizure. Billy and his girlfriend ain't looking so good after touching the statue.
No.
And in walks a guy. Just a dude. I don't remember his name. He's around for a while. I don't remember if he says his name, but he is...
Call him the apprentice, because that's what he is.
Yes. The apprentice of this order, that apparently their job is to keep Set trapped and guard that door. Sir, where were you?
Yeah, why were you not anywhere near the door?
Why are the doors of the building that housed the devil not locked?
That is a good question.
Why?
Because plot, that's why, Jared.
I said that we would never do an ad. Simply Safe.
Oh my god.
I just break into a Simply Safe ad right there.
ADP.
Like, anything. Like, hire Kevin McAllister from Home Alone to make sure nobody gets in there. Do something.
He's pretty good at that.
He is pretty good at that. And he says that there's always been a guardian, but my favorite thing is his opening line walking is, "Who are you people?" Which is so funny.
It made me think of the SpongeBob meme.
Patrick with the eyes on the rock. Yep.
Who are you people?
Same. And he's like, no, we can't, now none of you can leave, which I don't know why they can't leave, actually, thinking back on it. They probably should have been able to leave.
The only connection I had was like, the one lady who was kind of possessed by Set, but was the only one, and that was a note that I had that I'm like, how is she more affected than the other two people who touched it?
I think because she was not pure of heart.
She was first. Oh.
I think because they made her up as being a bad person.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very horror movie trope.
It's because she was the only one who wasn't very clearly from New Jersey.
That's true, except for Billy.
She had an Eastern European dialect.
I am Russian. Please get me out of house. I do not want to be here. I want to be at party.
Oh, I am devil now.
I am devil. Oh, no. I'm devil. So, apparently once you touch the statue, the protection around Set is broken. But we learn that Set can not open doors that are closed and blessed by Amon-Ra's magic.
I feel like that's not true. I feel like it was just specifically the door. Like, if you open the door, the statues just gave you a connection, right?
He said at the time, because I wrote down what he was talking about, that touching the statues broke the protection.
All right.
But also the protection is still there, so I think they might have missed that one in their rewrites.
Sure.
Because that might be the reason why they can't leave. But either way. So apparently, Amon-Ra, the sun god, when he's not playing wide receiver for the Detroit Lions,
sure.
is blessing doors. It's a reverse vampire situation. Set has to be invited out, whereas a vampire has to be invited in, So basically, this intern, it's like his first day on the job or something. He doesn't have enough faith.
Yeah, I'm not faithful enough to seal the door.
Okay. Sure.
I'm real nervous about that.
He's real nervous about it. And then we're back at the party.
Yep.
Again, it's unclear where this party's supposed to be with people talking about how, like, going and getting Claire or friends or whatever. And the one guy hears a voice from behind the door. The friend that was like, she's touching things. And it's like, no, you got a girl kidnapped back there. Which, good reaction, actually. Strange guy won't let you behind the door and girl's calling for help. All right.
It's valid.
I get it. And if somebody told me, no, that's actually the devil behind that door, I would probably not believe them either, to his credit. So he calls the cops. Police also break into the party in this scene and are just the police officers walking around, like almost like interrogating people in like a circle about what's going on. And then the minor, the sophomore, the only one who's not a graduate student, yeah, vomits in front of the cop. And that's a problem, but we don't really, it doesn't come to any type of conclusion because Seth's going to come kill them all anyway.
Right. It's one of those, this party's out of control, but like, it's a pretty tame party from what I could tell.
It's like, the music's too loud.
We'll
turn it down.
And their justification is the music is loud enough that over the rain, the neighbors can hear it. I'm like, okay, I get that. But also, my God, the music is louder than the speech, so maybe they have a point.
Now, Steven.
Uh-huh.
You know what really puts me in the mood for romance?
Oh?
Being told by somebody that the devil's behind that door, but also maybe it's a kidnapping and our friend just had a seizure. Because Billy takes this moment to propose to his girlfriend still.
You know,
still.
It's not ideal, but let's get married.
Not ideal is an understatement.
Yeah. Yeah. Someone just had a seizure. People are about to die. We don't know that yet.
Yeah. Cops show up, unfortunately. and the one cop is trying to, like, figure out what's going on, who called me, blah, blah, blah. And the apprentice is like, no, listen, the devil's behind that door. Set is behind that door. Amon-Ra blessed it. And the cop's like, you're telling me the Egyptian sun god blessed it? And like, that's just a thing people know?
Yeah, I guess. I cannot, if I ever asked a random cop who Amon-Ra is, I would bet at least 98% of the time they would have no fucking clue.
Well, they'd say wide receiver.
Oh, sure.
At this point, but not back then. Back then, they'd have no idea what you were talking about. And so the one guy who is like, ah, oh, you kidnapped that girl, pounds on the door and she screams for help. And the cop's like, yeah, okay, no, we're going to figure out what's going on back there because you got a girl locked in that room. And opens the door and it's the devil.
Wait, before we open the door, the one random possessed lady is just naked for some reason.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
She just gets naked. And we're like, whoa, okay. Again, leaning more toward the porno, but we're coming right back because we clothe her. We like throw a sash over her or something.
We were one scratch guitar away from this being a horror porno. remember, kids, don't talk to cops. They won't believe you when you say that it's actually the devil possessing someone behind that door.
Yeah.
Yeah, so cop opens the door. Immediate death. Immediate Movie Maker 2007, Windows Movie Maker 2007 special effects.
Again, I'm not going to fault anyone for bad special effects.
No, it's almost nostalgic, honestly.
Yeah, and especially from an indie production like this. You're
yeah.
I don't know. You're going to get what you're going
to
get.
Although, like, lesson to any amateur filmmakers out there, practical effects generally look better at that level.
The best effect from this whole movie, and I'm jumping forward, is when the devil set spins someone's head around and he is forward and then we cut to him backwards and he's just wearing his sweatshirt backward. And like, from me as an artist, I'm like, yeah, I get how they did that, but it looked the best.
It was edited really well too.
Yeah.
Credit to them. And then we have a very long fight scene.
Yeah.
It is the apprentice versus Set. The apprentice has a tiny mirror that is an Ankh. And Set has the power of lightning, which she will never use again. Because that was probably expensive to do.
Yeah.
Or time consuming. And she keeps shooting at him. He keeps reflecting it. Or like stopping it. Doesn't really go anywhere. It doesn't like shoot off somewhere.
Pew, pew, pew.
This goes on for 45 seconds. A minute and a half?
Oh, it's longer than that.
Yeah.
It's longer than it needed to be. The idea was fun.
Yes.
The length, we could have cut some of that.
It was a little dark comedy-esque, to be honest.
Yeah, sure.
And she eventually just, like, overpowers him and kills him. And then she kills everyone else that isn't Billy or the friend in front of the door, and she steals some of their souls.
Yeah, there's a special effect where they're like, it's very clearly doubling up their body, where it flashes into this weird, it's not black and white and it's not sepia, but it's somewhere in between, mm-hmm. and their body is also doubled behind them. So you're like, I don't quite understand. And then we talk about, oh, she's stealing their souls.
And doesn't steal the girlfriend's soul because she was grabbing the Ankh when she was killed and is afraid of the Ankh or whatever. And then, now, okay. Acting is hard. Legitimately, acting for camera is so hard.
Agreed.
Especially because everything you do will feel too big. Everything you do will feel too small. You will feel like you're going too quick and too slow all at the same time. You have no idea how the camera is capturing you. They go to get these paintings that were above the statues to like capture Set or like deflect Set. I don't know how they know this, but that's okay. And we run into a lot of lack of urgency throughout the rest of the film at this point. Mm-hmm. And that's the tricky one, where it's shorter for newer projects is probably better, mm-hmm. because snappier scenes that have a little more urgency behind them is going to read better on a camera. Now, it was fun to watch.
It was fun to watch. From the perspective of, I'm watching this god kill all my friends, and then there's just a dude in the background with his hands in his pockets, I'm like, oh, maybe you should run.
Yeah. Yeah. And then a cop shoots Billy.
Yeah. You know what? The most relatable scene in the whole movie.
She's trying to get in the door, and he's like, no, nobody else can come in here. Nobody, don't let her out. We have to keep her trapped in here. And yeah, the cop shoots
she
Billy.
She just shoots him.
Now, I would like, Billy, if you are listening to this, thank you, and I'm sorry. And this was genuinely a treat. You know that your heart's on your left side, right?
Because oh, shit, wait.
Billy gets shot in the left side of the chest, which is where your heart is.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
And they treat it like a minor wound from here on out. And it is right over where your heart is.
Uh-huh.
It's literally anywhere else.
Not to pile on this one, but we then later tourniquet his heart wound.
At the shoulder?
That's not how that works. Again, love you, Billy. That was one of those moments that it took me out for a little bit because I was laughing a little bit.
It was fun.
It was fun.
Oh, and I will tell you, I can tell that Set has modern dance training. Set is doing a lot of modern dance in the lead up to their kills in ways that are actually kind of effective.
Mm-hmm.
And like it made me feel a little weird. And that's the goal. She's about to kill somebody.
She had a good ethereal something about her.
So from that part, Set gets out, goes to the party, starts murdering people. I did write down Billy saying humor's how I cope while he's getting his heart wound tourniquet.
Relatable.
Which, yep, very relatable. To the point my therapist is telling me to cut that shit out, relatable. This podcast is my therapy now as well. A lady of the order comes by and is like, I got here as fast as I could.
No, you didn't.
Was not very quick. You should have more than just an apprentice station. How many other gods are you guys guarding?
She said something about being upstairs, and I'm like, wait, what? It took you that long to get downstairs?
No, I think she meant that Set was in the basement. Like, that Set was downstairs. Although that doesn't make any sense either, so maybe not. This magic librarian lady can bring people back as long as their souls weren't stolen, which means everyone at the party who was being massacred, and we hear the screams from this house outside, Set stole all of their souls and just has them.
Yep.
Those people are dead.
They're on a nice keychain.
And then we get this thing of, well, she's going to be out in the woods because she doesn't want to be indoors because that's where Amon-Ra can trap her. So we keep doing these shots cutting back and forth between them talking about it and her just going through the woods like an office cutaway gag that is a little unintentionally funny, unless it's a dark comedy, in which case is actually you nailed it.
She's stalking them, but her face is very like,
gotcha. Ooh, can't see me over here.
I'm listening. I know what you're doing.
And that was very fun for me.
Yeah.
They use Billy as bait, basically, and fist fight Set in the woods. I guess Set, they do say that she's weaker, that she's weak from being trapped for so long. I guess she's out of lightning juice. and then trap her in a barn. And the barn is the new infernal room.
Hold up. Is Set just Palpatine?
Yes.
Comes back way later, is dark and spooky, has lightning powers.
Yes, basically.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of fist fighting the devil. Billy's like, I'm not going out like a chump, and decides to throw hands. Which, hey, that's one way to do it, I guess. And now Set is trapped in a barn somewhere in New Jersey or Long Island. For the rest of time.
For the rest of time. Hooray.
Steven, overall thoughts, mood, vibes?
Overall thoughts, this was very clearly an amateur project, like we said before. Yeah. I'm not going to dunk on it too hard. I always will appreciate people putting time and effort into making something that is theirs and their own. And with that, there will always be some small things that make it not work. Continuity is hard.
Yes.
Continuity is so difficult, and it's one of those things where they have entire teams just to make sure continuity is there. And we lost a lot of continuity in this.
Yeah.
But again, when you're making something and you're making it quickly with a very limited budget, you're going to get what you're going to get.
Yeah,
stop poking holes in the fun thing, damn it.
That is the thing. And you're seeing somebody's earlier work. You're seeing a first project or like a thing that they, I don't know if Billy wanted to make this his career and decided not to, or if this is something that was just like a one-off where he wanted to do something with his friends. Because these are, I mean, I think he said when his interview with us, like, these are his friends. These are people that he knows that he made this Tribal Council Entertainment Company with.
Amazing. I love that.
And like I said, I did a shorter, similar version of one that we never ended up finishing when I was in community college, actually. And like, that was a fucking blast.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt very like personal, almost, like watching it. Like it felt like something that was like seeing something that raw was really kind of interesting and new for me. Or
yeah,
at least it's been a while.
I will once again give credit. Anyone who makes a thing and finishes a thing and is willing to put that out there in the world and not just say, wow, I hate this, I'm going to shut this away so that nobody can see it. Big props. Major props.
My only difficulty in watching it was knowing we had to talk about it because it was something that is not a produced, like heavily produced piece of work. So approaching it a little bit differently. Like I had fun watching it on the couch with you.
Yeah. Like you said, it's a little difficult to talk about because I can't just aim any criticism toward a general, this is the movie. It feels more personal, like this is aimed at Billy, and I don't want it to be the case.
Well, and it's not cynical. Like a lot of the stuff we've watched that have been bonus episodes, like hell, the VR game is a cynical cash grab by Paramount, or Honorable Men is just straight up racist. Like Gone is a like really preachy, like revolution, like the book, like end times type of thing. And this is just a fun project he made with his friends that was kind of campy and fun to watch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like I said, much love. There are things I like, things I didn't like. And I am not the target audience as a horror fan, as I've expressed multiple times before, but, good job, Billy.
Yeah, and you have to go into this. If Billy wants us to put the link up and wants more people to be able to view it, go into it the mindset of you're watching like an early YouTube video, basically. Like you're not watching a new YouTuber where they have, you know, post-production and 10 million followers. You're watching like a web series that somebody made in 2008 before anyone knew that you could make money off of doing that kind of a vibe.
Yeah. Cool. Any thoughts from you before we jump into mailbag?
Do you want to rank it?
Oh, yeah. So just to give a quick rundown, right now our rankings are BattleBots, Game Changer, Top Shot, MetaQuest, The Mercenary, Total Drama, Endurance, Seeking Mr. X, Rumble in the Jungle, Gone, Castaway Island, and Honorable Men. I have a spot targeted for this one.
Okay.
It's right below Seeking Mr. X because I feel like it's about that same level of...
Sure.
This was an indie project. It is what it is. From an objective standpoint, there are faults with it, but like we had fun. So
right
below Seeking Mr. X.
Cool.
But better than Gone, because fuck Gone. Cool. And then any final thoughts from you?
No, that was it. And I've been to a lot of friends' like short film releases and stuff like that. And yeah, it felt very much like that. Kind of cool.
Okay. Then let's get into our mailbag. We have a good chunk of mail
here.
Yeah,
I bet we do.
But I just want to get through that. So, starting with Josh. Josh says, PG co-hosts a podcast called Reality Escape Pod, a podcast that covers reality shows, social strategy games, and escape rooms. Escape rooms?
Whoa, okay. That's a strange third thing to tack on there. All right.
One time she interviewed Neil Patrick Harris, who's a huge Survivor fan. Let's get Neil Patrick Harris on the show.
Yeah, that's the weight we're punching at.
She also hosts social strategy games, which often feature former Survivor players on her Twitch stream.
Cool.
That's cool. The word Stephen was looking for was fleur de lis for the French thing. Yeah. Also, one other thing you said back in Palau that I agreed with is that more people should be willing to threaten to force the tie at six, which is and will continue to be up to rocks through season 47.
Great.
So, see?
Yeah.
Force it.
I
go
think
for
it's,
it.
It's harder to, but I don't know if Denise, I don't know if it was better for Denise to do that specifically. Like, I think she could have made a better deal at five, but I would like to see people that are way on the bottom do that. Sorry, not people that are way on the bottom. In one where there's someone who's way out in front, like Tom was.
Sure. We have a message from Adrian. Hi, Stephen and Jared. I've been binging episodes trying to catch up before Micronesia, which is one of my favorite seasons from this era.
Ooh.
So sad that I caught up just when the big game happened and hoping Stephen didn't quit the show. I didn't. And now Jared will also quit the show.
I feel fine.
Yeah. It is what it is.
Yeah. But, no, Stephen, I won't go on long about it because I want to give our listeners the space. I will say watching the Vikings playoff game with you, that was the maddest/saddest I think I've ever seen you, maybe like one other time. And like by the third quarter, I was borderline uncomfortable, not with you, mm-hmm. with the game, mm-hmm. where I was like, wow, I can't even make fun of you. I just feel bad.
This is unfortunately what I expected. And it is one of those where it just like kicks you right in the teeth and you're like, fuck.
Yeah.
All right. Well, they saw a weakness. They carved us up all night long. It felt very similar to my feelings of the Minneapolis Miracle the week after, where we got our teeth kicked in by the Eagles. And man, it hurts. And you sit there and you watch and you're like, well, there's always next year.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. It's been so much fun listening to Jared's reactions. Steven, I don't know how you keep it together sometimes. I hope you're making note of some recent comments, especially in light of how certain contestants do in seasons coming up. Oh, don't you worry. I am clocking all the things that Jared says that I'm like, oh, that's a bad read.
Oh, and anything that he misses, you all will write in. I know that for a fact in my heart.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, I love Survivor China. There's a spoiler section, so I'm gonna cut that, obviously. But I love Survivor China when it was released. I remember it being a big deal that they were able to film in China, and I think it ended up being a great season. I'd agree that some of the challenges may not have been the most creative, but for the most part, I thought it really popped visually.
It got better after the merge. Mm. The pre-merge challenges were kind of lackluster. They got better after the merge.
Can't wait for Jared's reactions to Micronesia. I think it had one of the best runs of tribal councils in this era. I don't know if that's something you do or not, but would totally join Patreon just to see some of Jared's live reactions.
Just for the final tribal.
Yeah. Particularly in the back half of the seasons, you should totally make sure he's on camera while watching. There are some that I may pull some cameras, but I can't say that to, like, I can't tell you when I'm about to film because then you know something big's going to happen.
True. Although, if we're watching together, I probably won't notice.
Sure.
I'm really oblivious.
I don't have great insights into the season that Carl won't probably already know and tell you, so I'll leave this for now. Love your show, and now that I've caught up, I'll have to figure something else to do with my time. Keep up the great work, Adrian.
Thanks, Adrian.
Thank you. I want to note here while I'm halfway through our messages, I had my eyes dilated today, so if I, like, if I straight up misread your email, oopsie doops. Had a glasses appointment. Getting my eyes checked.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
You said you had an eye doctor appointment. I didn't realize you were getting your fucking eyes dilated today.
Do you not do that when you go get your eyes?
No, of course
checked?
I do. They have to do like extra stuff for me for diabetes. I didn't realize non-diabetics did that.
Yeah, you can pick and choose what you want to do. Mm. I didn't do the full range of tests that they could have done, but I did that one.
Nah, man, I've done like glaucoma testing and shit.
Mm. I think they've done that for me too. Mm. I went for the first time to the eye doctor last year in a long time. Mm, so okay. I was like, just do the range, do everything.
Just fuck me up, doc.
Whatever. This time we pulled back. Carl's episode 12 email. Picture the episode. It's Courtney having a nice Italian moment.
Gabagool.
Notes. Steven, of course you know this, but the Eric and Jamie thing was, for my money, one of the most shocking things to ever come out about any Survivor post show. I mean, since the year of 2007 up until 2024, when you guys had already been recording for a year, they had been seen as one of the show's biggest romantic success stories. They were basically one step below Rob and Amber in that department. Mm. And Eric, for his part, had a reputation of being one of the nicest guys to ever be on the show.
Yep. Yep. Anybody can be a monster.
Yeah.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know how much is known or how much is
things
confirmed.
Are still being worked yeah. on in courts.
Yeah.
I didn't say it in my last email because it's kind of obvious, but I guess it doesn't hurt to reiterate that James was far and away one of the most popular survivors for his era. Probably one half step below Yao Man, if I had to judge.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's also incredible that Yao Man's so popular because the season wasn't. Although he's coming back, so.
Right. Interesting of the editors to include the line from Amanda when her, Todd, and their sisters are in the water, and she says, "And we make a cute final three," right after they talk about how they can't let Denise into the final three. It seems to paint her and Todd in subtle villainous light, implying Denise isn't cute and giving off shades of the mean girls from Amazon who didn't bathe with the old hags of their tribe. That's a good point. Cool. And then also from Carl here, this is continuation of the episode 12. I think my last question may have been a little misunderstanding. Didn't mean to make it spoilery sounding. I just wanted to know if you guys think having a strategy of having someone who needs you and someone you need is a perfect way to navigate the game of game and win Survivor. Of course, there is an element of luck that goes into every game. I do think if you go into any season of Survivor with a set strategy, you are already losing and it's yes. the kiss of death. I just think that strategy and having two shields between you while calling the shots behind the scenes is one of the best ways to win the game of Survivor.
That's my favorite strategy.
Even if a swap occurs, you have to find someone who needs you and someone you need. Anyways, I feel for PG. She didn't start on the best tribe and clawed her way to the final five. Do you think she made mistakes? Yes. Do I think her approach to people get them on their side is not the most effective? Yes. I do love her fight, and I can relate to her in the sense of having some anxiety and getting people to listen to logic. Relatable. I feel like Denise knew she was drawing dead and didn't want to go to rocks, but the dismissiveness of PG is not smart when she is going to the jury. Thoughts?
Yeah, I think PG needs a Todd or an Amanda. Like, she needs to not be the leader making the decisions, because I think that when she makes decisions, she makes a decision and then tries to fit any square peg into a round hole. She needs somebody that can be a little more malleable as a partner in the game.
Valid. Next email from Josh. I'm not going to really go over Denise's post-game scandal because I'm 99% sure that it'll have been brought up by the time you read this. Yeah.
Yep.
If by chance not, just type her name into Google and you'll easily find it. Yeah. I remember Jared had talked about wanting a final tribal where someone really turned their entire game around. Todd turned his game around from likely third place finisher to winner by giving what is generally considered to be a top three final tribal performance.
Yeah, that was one of the best final tribals. I might have not given Todd enough praise because I was so blown away at how badly Amanda did.
Courtney was actually the favorite going in over both Amanda and Todd.
Whoa.
Yeah, crazy. He has the right mix of owning his game while still being apologetic, unlike Amanda, who apologizes way too much.
Yeah. Yeah, I started to pick up on that, like, thinking back. I was like, yeah, she apologized through a lot of the game, actually. Mm-hmm. Huh.
Courtney was explicitly cast on the show to be a pre-jury boot. She was recruited by being promised that she'd spend about 6 days in the game and then get a nice 30-day pre-jury vacation in China.
Oh, that's a great way to say fuck you to the producers and all the people that set you up to fail. Oh, I love that.
She found out afterwards the show's doctors were monitoring her extra closely because they were scared that they were going to have to medevac her at certain points.
Oh.
I mean, she's
I get it.
Very small.
Actually, I'm kind of glad the show would be doing that.
Yeah. Allegedly, Courtney asked Jeff to clarify in the reunion that she was not anorexic.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Still doesn't mean the way he phrased it was it wasn't weird.
Answer the question.
Answer the question. Todd's issues with alcoholism stopped him from being on Heroes vs. Villains, which in turn made him forgotten enough that he never played again. Thankfully, he recovered and was responsible for pushing Courtney to play again on Heroes vs. Villains. He now makes custom Funko orders, and here's one of the Survivor China cast. Like, this is the whole cast.
Oh my god.
Isn't that awesome?
The chicken one is great.
Yeah.
He really stands out.
Wow. Good for him.
Cool.
In regards to what other players knew about Amanda heading into Micronesia, I don't believe anything was ever confirmed by production. The spoilers had Amanda listed as the China winner, so certain players were operating under the assumption that she had won.
Oh, that sucks ass.
Amanda herself said she thought she won China until she got out there and saw no other winners. Todd said Courtney and Amanda were fully convinced she would win China.
Right, because when she's filming, she doesn't know who won. She just knows she was in the top three. Amanda, that is.
Yeah.
Huh.
They thought that... They had it in their minds that she had won China until the votes are read.
Wow.
Isn't that fun? Also, just to break down the final Micronesia cast. From Pearl Island, Johnny Fairplay. Vanuatu, Amy and Eliza. Panama, Suri. Cook Islands, Penner, Jonathan Penner. Mm-hmm. Parv and Ozzy. Fiji, Yao Man. China, James and Amanda.
Oh god, I really want Suri or Yao Man to win that season.
Do you have any pre-episode one predictions?
Well, so here's the thing. I'll talk about this when we record the episode. I had forgotten that I had seen the first episode of Micronesia.
Boo.
Now I only remember one detail of it, which is who goes home.
Sure.
Should we call him up? Yeah. Hey, John, you want to be the guest on this one? When I had seen David vs. Goliath, Micronesia was the other season on Netflix, and I was like, oh, I'll take a look at this, and watched the first episode and then fell off. Just had other things to do, and then they switched the seasons, and so I didn't like catch any more Micronesia. So I know the first episode, unfortunately, but I don't remember the rest of the cast, so I can't make predictions based on the end of the first episode
right
until I see more of it. So I'm in this weird place where I know too much and nothing.
Oh, believe me, if I was like Jared knows too much, I would have approached things very differently for the last like year and a half.
Yeah,
the way you have talked about this season makes me go, Jared doesn't know shit.
I don't know. I literally just know that Johnny Fairplay gets clowned on. Like, that's I remember him going home and be like, that guy's, wow, they sent the douche home. And then once Steve and I started talking about who was in Micronesia, I went, oh, that's that douche. Oh, it was the favorites that went to tribal. Oh, I did see that episode. Oh shit. Okay.
Oops. Okay, moving on. Carl's episode 13 email. Picture the episode. It's angry Denise. Denise being mad at life.
Yeah.
Notes. Amanda and PG were actually roommates for a while after the season ended.
And they were roommates.
So I guess this episode was the start of a real friendship. There you go. I actually believe PG when she says she's a positive person. She's been in a crappy situation for weeks. By the time she gets voted out, on the bottom with pretty much no friends and no hope. I think that would suck the positivity out of pretty much anyone.
Oh, I agree. And like, I'm sure PG is a positive person. Thinking back to like the first episode or two, like absolutely. Mm-hmm. You also got to know that you've not been being that person in front of everyone and they don't know that about you.
I can't blame her, though, especially when you're just sitting at tribal council being grilled with questions and you're like, yeah, everything in my life, I've been a positive person. And then these people behind you who know you only for these 30 days are like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and for all we know, there's a part of this cut out that's like, but here, it's actually been really hard and shit sucked.
Actually, I take that back. Most of these people have only known her for like 15 days.
Sure, yeah.
So, Mm. Also, because of her plucky underdog story, she got the moniker P-Jesus during this season, okay, which has always been one of my favorite Survivor nicknames. That's funny. Jared, I understand your take that the travel involved with the Great Wall visit could make it more stressful than the ideal, but come on. They're eating authentic hot pot at a private table on the Great Wall of China.
Listen, it's cool. It's just tough, and there's been other really, really, really good rewards, and also they didn't understand how hot pot works for some reason.
They maybe should have had a producer step in and be like, okay, do this. But yes.
It's a hot take, I understand.
No other tourists in sight. It might not be the perfect reward, but to say it kind of sucks, my Wisconsin taste buds cannot handle this spicy hot take. Excited for the finale. Oh, beautiful. Okay, moving on. Josh says Todd was not even contacted for Winners at War, which has a very small casting pool. So I think there's no shot we'll ever see him play again. As a side note, the fact that they didn't even bother to ask certain winners if they were interested is crazy to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Todd and Courtney remained very close after this. He said he definitely would have voted for her over Amanda.
Hmm.
And it also has never been officially revealed what the fourth place and below get for prize money.
Okay.
I wouldn't be surprised if it's almost nothing.
Yeah. Your day rate. Something like that.
Maybe $5,000 just for funsies.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I guess I can see an edit where Courtney wins, where Courtney wins, how the editing would go differently, because Courtney's kind of a side, almost like a comic relief character, but you can build a really good narrative around her story in China if the votes go a different way,
mm-hmm,
around being that person who's supposed to go home early, around, you know, everyone kind of quote-unquote turning their back on her and the John Robert side of things in her. I'm sure she has confessionals talking about her growth and all of that. You take out the Todd strategy confessionals, you put in the Courtney, here's how I've grown confessionals, and boom, there we go.
Boom, Courtney wins. All right. From Tyler. Tyler says, Denise ended up asking that the $50,000 be donated to the Elizabeth Glazer Pediatric AIDS Foundation.
Okay, so, great.
There you go. Everybody wins. Todd and Courtney remained close friends after the show. They both dated contestants from Survivor Tokenshins, which is season 18, for several years.
Hmm, okay.
Wild. I've been meaning to bring this up, but James was the first of the four people that Boo recruited for Survivor. So referring back to my previous descriptions of the people Boo recruited, we can cross the huge fan favorite off the list, which leaves two arguably the most divisive love them or hate them player in Survivor history. Three, someone only saved from being in contention from being the most hated Survivor player by the fact that they were booted so early they became irrelevant.
That wasn't Dave?
And four, the person who held the pretty much undisputed title as most hated Survivor player ever for several years. I know these descriptions sound very hyperbolic, but trust me, they're not.
I know nothing about hyperbole.
If I know who these people are, and I'm assuming who these people are, yeah, they're pretty accurate.
Hell yeah.
Cool.
You think by like the third person they'd stop taking Boo's suggestions?
Or
it's good TV.
Yeah. Okay. Connor's finale episode. China has everything. Great location, diverse cast, good gameplay, great challenges, and a great winner. I'll be honest, even if it's a pipe dream, I would love to see Survivor go back to the roots of the golden age of Survivor 15 through 20 and open up their budget to get us a new location, diverse cast members, or that ones that have very unique professions.
Hmm.
This season has some of the most unique backgrounds for players and mix of diversity racially. I think Survivor would be at its roots again. Just a little more adventure in the game and less advantages still have them, just not as many.
Sure.
Anyhow, enough of me rambling. I think that China is the perfect example of how a final tribal council performance is very important. Most of the time, an FTC performance can make you lose or gain 1 to 2 votes or 3 max. I think some players get content on being in the end and forget that the final tribal is very important to securing enough votes if you are neck and neck with another player. Rarely in seasons past and future does a player go losing completely into their final tribal and their speech alone wins them the game. It does happen, but no spoilers.
I think Ozzy's was really close, though.
It was up there. I think Todd gained votes, Courtney plateaued, and Amanda lost votes.
Yeah.
My question is, who do you think had the better final tribal so far, Chris from Vanuatu or Todd?
I think it's Todd. I think that the jury did a lot of the work for Chris. Like, Chris did great. I don't want to take anything away from Chris. But the jury just beating the shit out of Twyla in their questions and putting Twyla on the defensive, I think, did more for Chris. Like, this jury was pretty even-handed for the most part. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of exceptions, Denise, but it seems like a lot of their questions they actually wanted answers to, which is not always the case.
Sure. Yeah. He agrees. It'll go with Todd just because he was selling. He seemed a little more genuine than Chris.
I also agree with that. I think it was, if you take out even the Twilight part of it, like, I think Todd's was better in isolation as well.
Yeah. And goes on to say ranking final tribal council performances could be an interesting thing to do in the future. Would be cool. Might require a lot of effort to go back and watch some of these.
Go back and watch some of them. Yeah, for sure. Which, I mean, there's ones that stick out to me.
Right. But usually it's the bad ones or the really good ones. It's the middle stuff that I'm like, oh boy, we'd have to do some effort on that one.
Go ahead and throw Katie right down there at the bottom. Around the bottom.
Not ruling it out, but putting it on the side. A little shelf here. We'll come back to that.
And Amuse-Bouche or whatever it's called.
Amuse-Bouche?
Yeah, there we go. I took a shot.
It was close. Okay. Carl's finale. Boy, am I glad I'm not a Vikings or Lions fan. Yep, definitely didn't get disappointed in any way, shape, or form by an NFC North team this playoffs. Sigh.
I told Steven off mic, I feel okay. Like, the Commanders are red hot, and we had a bad game. We had a good season. Any team can have a bad game.
You had half a team, so whatever.
We had, 11 strictly defensive players on IR, defensive starters on IR. It's like, you know, the great thing about football is that it's the great and bad thing about football is it's one and done. Like, we don't have seven games in a series like baseball or something like that to really to be like, oh, come back and all of that. The human body just cannot handle seven straight games of football.
That's too much.
So sometimes a really red hot team, young team comes in and punches you in the mouth.
Yeah. At least we can join together as brothers in our grief. Although I don't get to have as much as you two poor souls. At least we have Survivor.
At least we have Survivor.
Picture the episode. It's Amanda. It's sad Manda.
It's sad Manda. She does have doe eyes. Like the sad doe eyes. Like, oh, please don't shoot my mom.
Feel like this encapsulates the final pretty well. Also, bonus picture. Todd serving looks. Look at him. Just that smolder.
He is a good smolder. Very attractive man.
There's a funny 115 entry that tracks Amanda's habit of making dead eyes, and this is one of my favorites. It's literally her in the background, like, I feel like that would be me if I got caught in pictures a lot.
Dissociating in the background?
Don't mind me. Notes. Ford canceled their sponsorship with Survivor after the truck incident, so.
Yeah.
That was that. Odd choice to put nicknames in the intro credits. Would have liked to see them do it for the jury, too. Jean Robert, the stupid asshole. China is always my argument for how a back-to-basic seasons can work. 16 people, just two idols, no twists, and if you aired the season today, it would totally be a hit. But who am I kidding? There is no God, only Probst.
Probst is God.
In Survivor, yes. Sympathy alone has never gotten anyone the million, but it maybe could have helped Denise. Unlike Twyla and Dream, she didn't screw over half the jury. And unlike Lil, no one hated her so much that they would have voted her out of the jury just so they didn't have to be around her.
Well, and, you know, Denise didn't get voted out and come back.
Yeah. Steven recapped the post-show story pretty well. The timeline was basically reunion on Sunday, school district makes the statement on Monday, Denise goes on the early show on Tuesday to clarify everything, and then donating to the AIDS Foundation. But her reputation was pretty smeared.
Yeah.
We'll never know how much of her story was half-truths or her trying to put public pressure on the school district to get her old job back. If you made a list of top 10 post-Survivor scandals, this would probably be on it. At least 2015-ish when I stopped paying attention. Yeah.
That doesn't seem like that big of a deal to me. Stolen Valor of a Lunch Lady is not, you know, some of the other ones of scandals are like, I mean, Eric. Like,
yeah.
It's very different stakes.
Very different stakes, but $50,000 thrown in makes it a very different story.
It is like she kind of read them for filth and lied about it. If you look at it from a certain perspective. Right. Like,
but she had no idea that the producers were going to do that.
Yeah.
So it's messy.
If she had been shown to be able to articulate her story even once in the season, I would maybe be able to put any nefarious intent behind it at all. I think she's just really oblivious.
Sure. Yeah, Amanda's jury performance is pretty famous for being one of the worst ever. I may have slightly different opinion from you in this, but I don't think it would have gone over that well earlier in, even in earlier seasons. Mm. All the way back in Borneo, Richard beat Kelly essentially because he owned his game and she didn't. And the jury thought she was wishy-washy. I think Amanda comes off in a similar way here. Although she definitely had a more strategic reason for it than Kelly did. Seems like Amanda thought being apologetic would be good jury management, where Kelly just totally disowned everything she did.
Yeah, it's a bad mistake.
It was a shocker to many people because not only did she get somewhat of a winner's edit, but Amanda was so widely spoiled as the winner that it was almost common knowledge. You wonder if her edit is there because they knew she'd be on Micronesia, or if it was just to make her a challenger to Todd.
Hmm. Or maybe even a little bit of spite. Oh, you guys think Amanda's a winner? All right.
Let's play into that.
Let's play into it.
Yeah. I wouldn't say her China game is the best non-winning game so far, but she was a very good player. Even so, she was seen as one of the most what-the-fuck casting choices for fans versus favorites. She's very solid strategically, but her personality and character just didn't really pop for the audience, who felt mostly neutral toward her. Yeah. But she had her own fans, of course.
Sure. And I think also in that cast, she fits in there pretty well.
Yeah. The sucks at life quote became Courtney's most famous quote of her Survivor career, and she spent a long time trying to distance herself from it.
Yeah.
Apparently, she's an incredibly nice person in real life, which is no surprise at all. Courtney was actually probably the least liked of the final three, maybe of the final seven. The Facebook boomers just didn't like her snarkiness and thought she was a brat, and they were still a big demo for the show. People with valid opinions liked her fine, though, and now she's pretty much universally loved.
People that weren't around when lead was in gasoline liked her. Nice. Have you ever seen that, like, the graph of, like, crime rates matched with the rate, or, like lead and gasoline matches 1-to-1?
No.
Oh, yeah. Overlay those graphs of, like, crime rates and, like, people alive when lead were in gasoline. Like, it's literally the same graph.
Wild.
Uh-huh. Turns out lead makes you really aggressive and have poor decision-making skills. We missed that shit barely. Thank God.
Hey, we had some good things happen in our life.
With all the other things... Well, we deal with microplastics.
Right.
With all the other things about me, can you imagine if I also had lead poisoning?
No, thank you.
To make me an aggressive psychopath?
I'm just gonna no thank you on that one.
I'm gonna take a no thank you, too.
Yeah, and to be fair to Probst, Courtney apparently asked that she be asked the anorexia question.
Okay.
That's what we said before.
Although, Jeff was still fucking weird about it, but that's just, it's a live show, he doesn't get another take, and he was a weird guy. That's much better.
Although maybe she should have given him some pointers on execution as well.
It's fucking waterboarding it out of her.
What happened to Todd is basically that he got caught up in the reality TV alumni party scene after China aired, and once his hype faded, he continued drinking heavily. It's heavily speculated that the show was worried about bringing him back for a second try because they're concerned it would result in a relapse afterward. Of course, addiction is complex, but you can't tie everything back to Survivor, but he has talked about how he didn't drink alcohol before Survivor because he grew up Mormon.
So the cut scene that's in the recap where we see him drink is literally the first time he's drank then.
I guess
not really drank before Survivor doesn't mean he hadn't drank anything ever before Survivor.
I can't
Survivor.
Explicitly say that, but...
Huh. Mm. Yeah, interesting.
And by now, there have been a lot more strategy-minded young male archetypes that have appeared more recently, and casuals would remember more anyways. I would argue that Todd was more significant in his time and a better character than a lot of them, but I digress. I would say the show probably just isn't very interested in bringing him back anymore, regardless of any addiction concerns.
Yeah.
Probst is not EP yet. What does that mean?
Executive
producer. Yeah. That will happen in 2010. I believe it's between Heroes vs. Villains and Nicaragua, but definitely by Nicaragua, he's executive producer.
Oh, they're going back to Africa at some point. Interesting. Okay. Wait, that's South America.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right.
I brain farted.
All in all, China was obviously very well received and did a lot to wash away the stink of Fiji. Micronesia will do even more to revitalize the franchise, so much that you could basically call it a reboot of the show. There are a couple revolutionary seasons that completely change Survivor in a permanent way, and Micronesia is one of them.
So China is the Vanuatu to Micronesia's Palau.
I would even argue it's the Borneo for everything that comes after it. So buckle up, Jared.
Ooh, okay. Also, I was thinking of Niger. That's why.
There you go.
Yep.
Damn, only 17 paragraphs. This must be my shortest finale email yet. See y'all in Micronesia.
I'm so hype.
And then one last email, this one from Michael C. Glad you guys enjoyed China. It's not one of my absolute favorite seasons, but I generally like, mostly due to the strength of its cast and overall presentation, set design, challenge design, rewards, etc. I personally have it somewhere in the top middle range of my full season rankings, but for seasons you've seen so far, here's where it falls. One, Africa. Two, Pearl what? Islands. Three, Vanuatu. Four, Palau. Five, Marquesas. Six, Guatemala. Seven, Amazon. Eight, China. Nine, Australia. 10, Borneo. 11, Exile Island, 12, Fiji, 13, Cook Islands, 14, All-Stars, and 15, Thailand. I almost thought I was reading it backwards, and then I saw Thailand at the bottom. I'm like, oh, no, never mind.
Wow. I mean, hey, that's why people love tier lists, because it's so subjective.
Everyone gets their own opinion. PG's fan favorite status was really cemented by her underdog edit in the last 2 to 3 episodes, especially in her boot where she's practically the main character for the whole episode.
Yeah, that's a Dan-esque episode, as I said.
Yeah. She was asked back for Micronesia immediately, but declined due to not wanting to do 2 seasons back-to-back. Valid.
Yeah.
We'll see if she learned anything years later in Cambodia. Lunch Lady / Custodian Denise is an interesting case study in wanting to obtain fame and use the show to make money. I think you're... description of the events is largely accurate. However, you should know, donated to the AIDS Foundation, did not keep the money. So make of that what you will regarding her motivations at the reunion. I will save my final thoughts on Courtney and Amanda for later seasons, as we'll see them again, but I did want to share that at the time it was heavily spoiled that Amanda was the winner, and we talked about that. Todd's win was seen as a huge surprise for viewers, as it was a major change of the pace for the show.
That's so funny, just because Todd is such a modern player, like I kept saying, that it felt so obvious that he would be the winner to me. Like, you could pluck Todd from China out, not modern day Todd from China out, pluck him into season 42, and he would fit right in.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, well, that can't be the winner. Everyone's going to see him coming because he's just too, but like, he's too good, but it's revolutionary. It's new. It's novel. So people would think it was Amanda. Wow. Okay. Yeah. Huh. I wrapped myself around trying to get to the answer that ended up being what everyone thought it was at the time anyway.
This shows that the evil mastermind archetype could win the game. He's also one of the first winners who I feel...
Wait. Could Hatch?
Right.
But I see what you mean. Yeah, people probably
Synth
forgot.
Hatch.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's also one of the first winners who I feel like you can really believe won the game at the Final Tribal Council, as he went in there likely in third place and a lot of the jury against him. People often say Amanda's poor performance led to his win, but I think that undersells how well he worked the jury, especially Jean Robert.
It's both.
Yeah. While Todd has struggled with alcoholism, he is apparently in a much better place now and still young enough to make a return appearance. I think it could be a possibility if interest is there.
50.
There were persistent rumors post-show that he and Frosty dated, never confirmed, but he actually does date a future Survivor contestant whom you will meet in the next few seasons.
Frosty gives Bi King energy. I know I've said that before. I just want to say it again. I love Frosty.
However, that person is not his future spouse. Something I want you to note is how Todd and Amanda perfected the strategy first employed by the Tina/Colby of eliminating the lesser members of their own majority alliance/tribe before members of the minority, while always ensuring they had a stable majority in the group. This is way more interesting than a straightforward pagonging.
Yes.
And opens up opportunities for people who realize they're on the bottom of their majority to begin working with the minority remnants to actually do actual power shifts. Something Denise and James, to an extent, failed to do.
Well, I think it also helps that there isn't, in that final 4 to 5-ish of Fei Long, there wasn't necessarily a hierarchy, or at least it didn't feel like they knew that there was a hierarchy. Mm-hmm. Like, you just said that Todd and Courtney felt like Amanda probably won and she came in third. Like, it was, I could see an argument for all of them besides maybe Denise to be like, I'm not on the bottom. No, I have this connection with this person and we want to backstab that person because he has, in this, or he has, James has two idols, or because Todd is, or Courtney's, well, too well liked, or Todd's too ambitious. Like, everyone has a path, but if you have like that strict Palau-esque hierarchy that Tom somehow got away with, you are just, you're setting yourself up to get stabbed in the back immediately.
Yeah.
It's why the Panama Final Five worked, or four, or whatever it was, worked so well, because it was like, yeah, no, first of all of you fucking hate Terry, but second of all, none of you are like clearly in charge necessarily. I mean, RS was, but you're not, you all have a path.
Yeah. Gotta have a path. Looking forward to you guys talking on Micronesia, as there's a lot to discuss there. Jared's end of episode comments projecting forward to Micro already have me cackling with glee. Both of the things he got so right and things he got so wrong.
Hilarious.
Love it.
Off of what? I don't remember what I said besides that Amanda probably doesn't do well because she looks well fed at the reunion.
All right. That's all our emails.
The things I say are not retained in my mind.
In one microphone, out the other.
That's not how microphones work, Steven.
Huh?
For my co-host Steven, this is Jared.
For my host Jared, this is Steven.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.